Good morning. You are tuned in to Community Radio, listener-supported KGNU. I'm Maeve Conran, and coming up on today's Morning Magazine, we'll hear why some residents in Boulder are concerned about ongoing delays by the city in selecting a vendor for setting up an online petition system for ballot initiatives. This is something voters in Boulder approved in 2018. Then we'll hear about the plight of Palestinian refugees living in camps in Beirut, Lebanon. Some have been there for seven decades. We'll speak with the Denver-based nonprofit Beirut and Beyond. They're seeking to raise awareness of this issue and they'll host an event in Denver tomorrow. After that, we'll have the Resistance Radio calendar. And after headlines from the BBC, it's time for a new commentary from Jim Hightower. Then at 8:35 on A Public Affair, Frank Dubofsky speaks with the nationally renowned criminal defence attorney, Paul McCormick. They'll talk about the criminal justice system. At 9 o'clock, it is media analysis from Counterspin, rounding out this morning's news on public affairs. But first, we'll begin with the latest local headlines. Here's Jamie Sudler.
Tomorrow is election day, and while it's too late to mail in a ballot, voters can turn them in at drop-off locations until tomorrow at 7 p.m. There are two statewide measures. Proposition CC asks voters to allow state government to retain revenues it would otherwise have to refund because of the Taxpayer's Bill of Rights, or TABOR. Proposition DD asks voters to allow sports betting through state-licensed casinos, with revenues from a tax on wagering being applied mostly to water projects. Voters in Boulder will choose among candidates for city council and also ballot measures addressing tobacco and vaping, middle-income housing, and sales and use tax extensions for open space. In Aurora, five candidates are vying to become the city's next mayor. In other cities in the metro area, voters are being asked who should fill school board seats in addition to questions about local issues. At a town hall meeting in Aurora on Saturday, speakers expressed concern about excessive force and use by police, officer-involved shootings, and transparency. The Sentinel reports that the meeting, hosted by the city's state legislative delegation, comes after a spate of recent incidents involving the deaths or injuries of people caused by police officers. About 40 community members attended the panel discussion. Several people expressed their concerns about police body cameras that seemed to be shoved aside or thrown from officers during incidents. Others wondered whether officers face consequences such as criminal charges when they use excessive force. Denise Mays, policy director of the ACLU of Colorado, said that there is a pattern that is disturbing and that the existing police review board only examines officer-involved cases when either the officers or the chief asks for it. She supports an independent review system. Anti-Semitic propaganda was posted on Boulder's Pearl Street Mall at about 10:30 on Saturday night. A group of men posing as Jews put up flyers claiming that the Holocaust was, quote, impossible, and academia is dominated by Marxist Jews. The men were live-streaming what they were doing. However, the Daily Camera reports that others who witnessed the group removed the propaganda. Boulder police had not received any complaints about the flyers, according to a spokesperson. Colorado Attorney General Phil Weiser is investigating whether major television distributors have overcharged their customers during a recent blackout that has blocked sports fans from watching the Colorado Avalanche and the Denver Nuggets. In a letter to DirecTV and Comcast, the AG's office said that charging a regional sports fee during the blackout may constitute a deceptive trade practice under the state's Consumer Protection Act. The Denver Post reports that the AG's letter also indicates that Weiser's office has opened up an additional investigation into other fees and charges imposed on internet and television services that have the potential to confuse and mislead customers. Weiser said that the DirecTV's actions in particular have been very concerning. DirecTV is owned by AT&T. A spokesperson for Comcast told the Post that it had already issued partial credits to customers. Weiser said that his office's letters indicate that the state's prosecuting arm is putting down a clear signal for companies that change their products without alerting or reimbursing their customers. It will take decades for a sage grouse found only in western Colorado and Utah to recover its numbers enough not to require protections under federal law. The Grand Junction Daily Sentinel reports that a draft recovery plan by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service estimates that it could take 50 years and $500 million to restore the Gunnison sage grouse, which is currently listed as threatened. Colorado Parks and Wildlife estimates that there are in total about 3,000 of the birds. Conservation groups claim that the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Bureau of Land Management are working at cross purposes, with the BLM providing inadequate safeguards for the Gunnison sage grouse in its plans. Similar concerns have been raised by the State Department of Natural Resources. For the next few days, we can expect sunny skies and no precipitation. Today, the high will be around 46 and tomorrow about 57. Right now, it's about 37 along the Front Range. For KGNU, I'm Jamie Sudler.
It's 9 minutes past 8 o'clock. In November 2018, voters in Boulder approved a ballot initiative that authorises the City Council to adopt ordinances to allow electronic signatures or endorsements to be submitted to get an initiative on the ballot. This would take away the need to have those people at the grocery stores and other places around town gathering signatures. However, the process has been significantly delayed, and this has prompted a lot of criticism from election transparency advocates, including Steve Pomerance, who's a former Boulder City Council member, and Evan Ravitz. Now, both of them served on the Campaign Finance and Elections Working Group, and that actually supported that 2018 initiative.
Here's the fundamental deal with this. This online signature process, how it's done is totally dependent on what the Secretary of State will allow the city to do. The Secretary of State is the entity that has the data that allows you to verify who endorsed an online petition. And that data is date of birth and driver's license numbers, basically, is what they use. That's the proprietary data. It's in their, then they have a database with it, and they have signatures, but we wouldn't be using signatures. And so the question is then, how does that data get applied to these online endorsements to check to make sure the person who checked the box is that person? And the range of possibilities is enormous when you think about it. On the one end, the Secretary of State, and this was Evan's idea, so I'm not taking credit for this. They just put another page on their website. And so you access it just like you do, and I'm basically repeating what Evans told me. You basically do exactly what you do to change your party affiliation or to register to vote, which is you sign up with your name and your date of birth and your driver's license number, and that gives you a high level of security, and then you would go to the Boulder petition page. And you would be able to read the petition, and you would be able to see a pro and con if the city chooses to do that. And then you could check the box if you wanted to. That's the simplest, most secure system.
Secretary of State Jenna Griswold said at a public meeting in Boulder that Colorado had the best election security of any state. So why should Boulder try to replicate that here? And with the complications which the Denver system has of synchronizing the two databases every day.
Right. So that's one end of it. That's like the obvious one. On the other end, Boulder would have to create its own system of where people would check the box and so on. And then somehow they would have to take whatever people put in as their birth date and driver's license and compare it to the Secretary of State's database. Well, how are they going to do that? The Secretary of State can forward files, secured files with passwords or whatever, you know. Boulder could put it on a thumb drive, their information, and go to Denver and check it out, you know.
Slip it to you under the desk.
You know, yeah, and it becomes more and more complicated. Now, the reason that the RFP is so lengthy and difficult to respond to is because Boulder never resolved this with the Secretary of State before they put out the RFP. Now, I'll give this. Our county clerk just got elected, right, in this last January. I mean, they got put in office, I should say. They got elected last November. Same with Jenna. Right. Well, how about by March, maybe we could be ready to figure out what the angle is on this, and then this all would have been over with, because once you know how you're working with this database, asking people to come up with a proposal is much, 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 much easier. And that is where the problem is. Just to throw out one more angle on this one, which is an idea that's come up in separate conversations, is the credit card idea. If the Secretary of State makes it so hard to use their database, which we don't know yet what they're going to do, just have people buy for a dollar, buy a chance to sign up. I mean, the credit card system is really secure when you think about it. And so they go online with their credit card, and just like you go buy a pair of socks on Amazon, you go and you buy for a dollar, you got a chance to sign up. And as Evan says, you can always give people their dollars back. And that's really secure.
So do you see all this delay between what's not being rolled out in a timely manner here in Boulder because of this intersection between Secretary of State and the City of Boulder?
Well, no, that was the job to get cleaned up in the beginning. That's not why it's a delay. That's something that needed to get done. But that was obvious right from the beginning. So it isn't an excuse for a delay. It's the thing you knew you had to do in order to issue an RFP that would be easy to respond to and would be clear. And I just read the RFP again this morning, and my God, I can't imagine somebody trying to figure out what they're supposed to do because they don't know. It isn't in the RFP.
But some folks and some vendors did
respond
to the RFP, including MapLight. And this is this nonprofit that has been working in California. And Evan Ravitz, you said that what you think the city should have done would have, instead of putting out an RFP, was just to work with MapLight and use their system. So take us through exactly who MapLight are. They are a nonprofit. They're based in California, and they have a version of this already working with the California Secretary of State's office. Is that correct?
They have a different thing that's part of the Secretary of State's website, which gives viewers better information about campaign finance than the Secretary of State's website had done before. So it's like a plug-in or something like that. To me, these people are geniuses. To me, the right thing to have done was let them give us the free system. We test the hell out of it. We ask all the great programmers in Boulder, can you hack this? Blah, blah, blah. And then if it works, we have a free system. Not only free for us, but since it's open source, free to every other city and state that wants to adapt it to their system. And then if it didn't work, it was hackable or something, then issue the RFP and go with something. Because the only reason I even knew anything was going on wrong, because I thought, well, if MapLight goes through the process and they have the free system, everyone else wants thousands of dollars, MapLight will win. But then I see in the proposed city budget, the city wants $400,000 for an online petition system. This is a travesty to spend $400,000 when we could have one at least to try it out for free.
Well, where are we right now with this entire process? Because the idea had been to have this rolled out for the November 2020 election. That looks like it's definitely getting pushed out at least a year. So where are we
right
now?
But consider this. That was an absurdity in the city attorney's response to my mass email that you got, in which he said, it was an untruth and an absurdity. He said, in the RFP, it says we'll have this ready for the November 2020 election. I asked him where, because it's six different files at the RFP. He didn't respond. So I searched each file, and 2020 never appears, and November only for November 2019. So it's not in there, and it would be an absurdity because petitioning has to be ready months and months before the election, not in time. This isn't a voting system, which is a conflation the city attorneys have made twice now in the RFP. They call them votes instead of endorsements. They even call them a third thing, an attestation. This is a technical thing. You use the same word three times. You don't. This isn't a literary thing where you're trying to show off your vocabulary or just be more expressive. You simplify it. They complicated everything. It's impossible for me as an outsider, and even for Steve, having been on the inside, to figure out what's going on.
Well, Steve, do you have any insight on Steve as to what is going on? MapLight were one of the groups that did respond to the RFP. There doesn't seem to be any indication that this is going to get up and running anytime soon. So November 2020 is not going to be an election where we're going to see online petitioning. That's what it looks like, potentially the year after. What's your sense as to what's going on?
I can't say as I really know what's going on. What I have heard, the most important thing I've heard recently, is finally they're having these technical conversations with the county clerk and the Secretary of State's office and the city. So maybe they'll have a clear picture of actually the context into which this will be embedded. That is to say, somebody who's writing software will know what form they'd have, what data they have access to in what form. That's the critical thing, because otherwise you don't know what you're doing. But in terms of getting the thing up and running, there's a lot of noise around, we have to test this and be all this secure and all this thing. Two things on that. One thing is, if you go back and you look, as I said, back only a few years, it was totally insecure. And there was, you know, any amount of rampant fraud could occur, and some certainly did occur. So, and this is a petition. This is not voting.
Voting is anonymous, and therefore you can't verify it. I can't call you and say, did you really vote for Joe? But if you sign a petition, your name and address is on it. I can look you up and I can call you and ask you. It's verifiable. So it's identified like a credit card transaction by the billions every day. But voting shouldn't be online, most experts think, because it's anonymous.
Yeah, but the other thing is about this whole testing thing. There's nothing to stop the city. The way 2G was written allows the city council to basically design this process. And there's nothing to stop them from running tests, real tests. That is to say, let's say they want to put a tax on the ballot for 2020. And they can basically put it on their website and ask people who think this tax is a good idea to check the box. They already designed the thing. It's not like, you know, then they can put it on the ballot themselves at the end of August if they don't get the signatures they want, or maybe they want to test to see if there's support. So they can do a real test for 2020, and that would be very useful, because then people would start getting used to the whole idea of this online system.
Steve Pomerantz is a former Boulder City Council member. He, along with Evan Ravitz, who we also heard from, both served on the Campaign Finance and Elections Working Group, speaking there about the delays in selecting a vendor for the voter-approved online ballot submissions in terms of getting a citizen-led ballot initiative on the ballot. Now, KGNU reached out to the City of Boulder, and in September we were told that the city had intended to have the finalists down selected earlier, but they received 9 proposals, which was a much higher vendor response than they'd anticipated, and so it is taking longer. And I reached out to them again last week and said there was no further information available on that RFP process. Now, we'll continue to follow this, and you can find out more online at news.kgnu.org. Well, there are hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. Many families have been there for generations. This summer, thousands of Palestinian refugees protested in and around their camps to demand that the Lebanese government end its requirement that they must obtain a work permit to gain employment. This is even for those who were born in Lebanon. While Suzanne Molnar first became aware of the plight of the Palestinian refugees in Lebanon several years ago, and it prompted her to found the nonprofit Beirut and Beyond, which is based in Denver.
In 2004, I found myself in Beirut, Lebanon, as one does. I was checking up on other work going on, and I had an opportunity to walk through Burj Al Barajni, Palestinian refugee camp on the outskirts of Beirut, Lebanon. And I had done humanitarian aid work all over the world, and yet I was in shock that I didn't know there were permanent refugee camps where Palestinians had been refugees for decades. And after I returned to the U.S., I decided that I wanted to serve this people group, and I moved my whole life to Beirut in 2006.
Give listeners a sense of what these refugee camps are like, because I think often when we use that term, people have a sense of a temporary situation, but people have been living in this for decades. So just give listeners a sense of what we're actually talking about.
Sure. It's 71 years, actually. And so in a country like Lebanon, you have third and fourth generations of stateless people living in camps. So the camps are in Lebanon, are, I'll focus on Lebanon, are densely populated. Palestinian refugees lack basic human rights, such as the right to employment, education, and healthcare. In Lebanon, they are legally banned from 70 different professions. This summer, the Minister of Labor also decided to pass another law saying what professions they are legally able to work in. They would need a work permit, which Lebanese employers would probably not be willing to grant. So technically, work is almost impossible legally for Palestinian refugees in Lebanon. And their health care and education only comes from UNRWA, which is the UN organization that works with them. The camps are basically, because they're, you know, it's hard to describe, but the camps are basically neighborhoods now. So think of like ghettos where you don't have proper infrastructure because they were set up in haste and temporarily built. There isn't a sewage system. The electricity is illegal. The water is contaminated. So you have the basic infrastructure problems. There isn't trash removal or police or civil defense.
So what is day-to-day life like for these multi-generations of Palestinians who have known nothing but this? I mean, what opportunities, if any, then are available to them?
Yeah, I mean, that's the issue going forward. And, you know, this summer, because of the new law that was passed, there were mass demonstrations. Lebanon is the size of Rhode Island, and there are 12 Palestinian refugee camps. So every Friday, I was there this summer, every Friday there were mass demonstrations in the camps demanding their rights, you know, the legal right to work and to eat. And talking to some of the, you know, my Palestinian refugee friends, they're like, how are we supposed to eat if we can't legally work? There were also mass demonstrations from Palestinian refugees at embassies demanding the right to immigration, the Canadian embassy and the Australian embassy. You know, that's part of the issue, because when you don't, and it's really hard for Americans to grasp that when you don't have citizenship, you don't have a legal right. Like, you don't participate in the social or political or economic makeup of your host country. So, let's see. For example, in Shatila camp in central Beirut, we do work there. This year, Lebanon is on like a French education system. So the ninth graders take a test determining what course in high school they will take, whether it's technical or literary. And less than 15% of Palestinians of the ninth graders passed the test. So you're looking at uneducation and anger and violence, and you know, militias are also in the camps and control the area, since the Lebanese army and government does not.
You mentioned that the only funding is coming from this United Nations agency, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency. They're the ones who are operating these camps. There has been a lot of controversy about that, because it does seem that Palestinian refugees are treated differently than refugees around the world. And when I say differently, I mean much worse. Give us a sense of that and the relationship, because there was also concern recently about a cut in funding to that agency.
Sure. Yeah, the U.S. cut all funding last year, which has put a huge strain on the agency. So you've got a couple different issues with UNRWA. UNRWA was set up as a temporary agency in 1949 to address the Palestinian refugee crisis. And they were never meant to be a resettlement agency. So when people talk about refugee status or stats around the world, they're going to be quoting the UNHCR, which is a resettlement agency. The Palestinians also have a different refugee legal definition, which allows them to pass refugee status on to their descendants because there is no citizenship to pass on. And that is the key legal difference between a Palestinian refugee definition and a Palestinian refugee definition from the UNHCR. The other important note is that UNRWA was set up before the UNHCR came into being.
Suzanne Molnar of Beirut and Beyond will discuss the organization's work in Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon and Jordan at Coffee at the Point, which is on East 26th Avenue in Denver. That's an event that's happening tomorrow evening at 7 p.m. And you can find out more about the organization at beirutandbeyond.org. And time now for more events in our Resistance Radio calendar. This evening at 6 p.m., a special Day of the Dead vigil to remember individuals affected by human rights violations and medical neglect in the GEO Detention Center. It happens at the GEO Detention Center on North Oakland Street in Aurora. It's gonna happen. This Friday, November 8th, Conversations for a Progressive Future, the role of independent media in 2020, a discussion with David Barsamian of Alternative Radio and Norman Stockwell, who's publisher of the Progressive magazine. It's Friday, November 8th from 6:30 p.m. at Eaton's Humanities, room 150 on the CU Boulder campus. You can find out more information about all those events and more online at news.kgnu.org. Just click on Resistance Radio. Some folks are gonna get the notion, I know. They'll say I'm preaching hate.